So just before we leave today, while I was preparing, it came to my attention that the quote of paragraph footnote 79 on page 22, the quote that begins "however" is not actually a quote. So if you could take quotation marks off that, it's a sentence but not being actually a quote. Thank you.
Sorry, I've used a lot of them.
Footnote 79.
79.
On page 22. The first part in quote marks is not a quote.
So where should the quote marks go?
From where on the page where it has 170. That's a quote. If you could, that is my sentiment of what I understood Mr. Scarsdale to say, paragraph 115. Thank you. Have we covered the points of paragraph 54A and B, but not 54C, where we talked about consent reviews, and I just wanted to note there that under the Resource Management Freshwater Farm Plan Regulations 2023, recertification of FEPs 5 yearly or 12 months after certain events does not need to be informed or influenced by new CCCV information. So that relates to whether the new information will come in and take effect. That's my reading of it anyway. I couldn't find anywhere where the new CCCV information explicitly had to be taken into account with the 5 year reviews of FEPs.
So, why drag people through the process?
Yes. It may be implicit, I mean, others may argue that it's implicit. Paragraph 55. We've already discussed the provisions of the NBPA that provide a 10-year maximum consent duration for consent applications lodged on or after the Waikato Region's NBPA date, and for resource consent applications made between the date of royal assent and rules providing allocation methods. In the first NBEA plan having legal effect, the NBEA provides maximum duration of 5 years after Council has not stated when it intends its allocation rules to take effect. And the opening submissions of the Regional Council essentially are set out there. So, Mr. Trevolco and Mr. Sinclair and Mr. Trevolco have proposed a 15-year consent term for Policy 7 so that farming consents don't need to be reviewed until the plan after the freshwater plan review. So that's the plan after the December 2024 plan change. And my submission is this fails to address the clear policy intent that's now found in the NBEA and is contrary to the direction to implement the NPCFM as soon as practicable. The NBEA also includes provision for establishment of a freshwater working group required to report to the Minister that will consider and make recommendations on matters relating to freshwater allocation and a process for engagement between the Crown, EVM and HUFO at the regional or local level on freshwater allocation. It includes resource allocation principles and a new comparative consenting process. So while perfect rules may not exist for allocation at this time, the regulatory context is rapidly changing and certain tools around further development that may allow limits to be developed at subcatchment, if not farm scale.
One would expect that the resource allocation principles so called in section 156 of the NBEA will need some elaboration, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Sustainability, efficiency and equity.
Yes.
Different people would have very different views about that.
No doubt. They will, Your Honour, but the essential proposition here is simply the fact that the regulatory framework goes rapidly changing.
Oh, indeed. Yeah.
So, and of course we have to wait to see with what's happening in the NBEA. But the first and first serve principle has been under scrutiny since I was at the Ministry for the Environment many years ago.
Well, there was always a concern that the broader application of the Fleetwing decision beyond allocation of a spatially restricted resource such as the CNA and application of it to water, the abandonment of principles such as Keen and so on under the Old Water and Soil Conservation Act always seems surprising. It's equally surprising it took so long for people to realise that first in, first served was not actually a sustainable principle.
Yes, so even if the NPEA is to be repealed, it would be very surprising if that principle continued into the future, in my submission. Paragraph 61. WRC's version of Policy 7 would negatively impact the ability of communities to achieve Objective 1, China to Whenua to achieve aspirations under Objective 4, and the transition of further land to vegetable production. And the word generally in Policy 7 would allow consents to be granted for up to 35 years. If many consents are catered for under this allowance, it could be some very, very considerable time before outcomes are realised. While the primary production sector seeks certainty, a high level of certainty cannot be provided at this time. More significant change is going to be required. This fact should be confronted and not hidden. The very nature of a two-stage approach is that it creates uncertainty for investment. And it's, I note there that the freshwater plan change is required to insert interim and medium-term goals in 10-year increments, which in my submission suggests 10 years is the appropriate duration. Should the Regional Council include another permitted activity role in its freshwater plan review, it could be that an NPSFM compliant plan change will not influence the consenting process in any meaningful way until after 2026, perhaps only influencing those subcatchments in the last tranches of Table 311.2's application date. whereas farming within lake catchments has for good reason been placed in the first consenting tranches. Under the Regional Council's proposal, farming in those catchments would not be influenced by an MPSM compliant plan change until 2040, which is too late for lakes. And if I can diverge there and refer back, there are no interim targets for lakes at all, and the long-term targets for lakes are the MPSM bottom line, so are interim. Due to the high vulnerability of lakes, ongoing degradation of their water quality, and in the absence of any meaningful TASs for lakes, Fish and Game seeks a 2035 cut-off date for the duration of success in the lake sub-catchments. So this does differ from Ms. Marr's proposed policy, which provides a 10-year consent term, but they're possibly not so much because the lakes are in the first tranches of Table 3.11.2, so we'll be up first anyway. Now I turn to the narrative attribute states for wetlands other than the Whangaremo and baseline and maintenance states for lakes. Now, in paragraph 69 through to 70, I discuss the differences between the experts on the narrative states for wetlands, stating that Dr. Robertson's evidence should be preferred. Paragraph 70, the experts agree there are potential methods to maintain ecological integrity of freshwater wetlands where certain attributes could be determined within certain ranges, and also agree that there is guidance available to enable an assessment of the condition of wetlands in regards to contaminants. Primary submission here is without narrative wetland states, there's a danger wetland health could be misunderstood by certified farm planners, because PC1 does contain a general policy guidance for wetlands, but wetlands are often viewed as attenuation devices. So there's a real risk certified farm planners will not appreciate the relevance of the high level policies to on the ground decision making. Narrative states would address this because it is the target attribute states that are required to be communicated in the CCCV. And diverging again, the narrative states will be placeholder states, until more certain states can be provided. Lakes provided for the maintenance and improvement of lakes cannot be placed on the too high basket. Shallow lakes over a hectare were identified in PC1. There are 59 named lakes, 35 peat lakes and 15 riverine lakes. However, map 3.11.1 does not clearly show the lake catchments. The NPSFM has compulsory values for lakes, ecosystem health, human contact, threatened species and the honeycomb. Mr. Clee's evidence sets out that his appendix 1, his proposed current NPSFM attribute states for 39 monitored lakes in PC1 to be included in Table 3.11.1d. Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence was that while he supports the setting of baseline attribute states for lakes, I understand that there has been no analysis undertaken to determine what policies and methods would be needed within PC1 to achieve new targets if they were included through this appeals process. The statutory obligation of WRC to maintain the quality of water and lakes is not optional, and there is no technical disagreement with Mr. Clee's table. Readers of the plan should be provided with baseline, i.e. current states, for 31 lakes. The JWS, that should say lakes, not wetlands. Top of page 28, states JWS lakes, states a quantified baseline would have the following advantages. And that quote has been set out there. In method 3.11.3.1, non-regulatory action plans, including the shallow lakes management plan and lake catchment plans, are only part of the solution. Mr. Fee's evidence is that while action plans often address the low-hanging fruit, such as interfield litigations and community engagement, they have not addressed nutrient load reductions that are needed. So Dr. Scarborough states the Regional Council recommends lake-specific action plans to address lakes not meeting national bottom line. The question whether approaches bringing landowners on a voluntary journey would be sufficient is guided by the NPCFM, which contains Appendix 2B, Attributes Requiring Action Plans, and 2A, Attributes Requiring Limits on Resource Use. And 2A includes several lake attributes. Paragraph 77. In summary, there's no good reason to reject reflection of baseline states for lakes in PC1. Interim target attribute states and appropriate long-term target attribute states for lakes are also needed. Fish and Game accepts that those will be notified in the freshwater policy review, and it's currently uncertain whether this will be done on an appropriately defined basis, which raises the issue of FMU categories for lakes. If I can turn to paragraph 79. Fish and Game seeks different FMU categories for lakes. Ms. Maher's evidence is that lake FMU support catchment action plans and support development of more bespoke target attribute states required for individual lakes. Current lake FMUs are riverine, peat, dune and volcanic, derived from the Waikato Region Shallow Lakes Management Plan that uses the same classification scheme. Mr. Lake's evidence is that lakes from the same geomorphological origin, the current categories, often cluster into quite different lake classes for the purpose of management. Mr. Clee recommends each lake have its own FMU, or where clusters of lakes in close proximity have similar ecosystem health drivers, these be grouped into one FMU. And that is not precluded by the fact that the Regional Council's Lake Monitoring Program does not have a sampling point on every named lake. Showing lakes more clearly into their catchments would likely have prevented lakes from being missed in the heat mapping exercise undertaken by Dr. Scarsbrook for the purpose of developing the priority contaminants table. That table has been withdrawn due to deficiencies, and priority contaminants are now to be signalled through the CCCD. This is further evidence of the way PC1 overlooks lakes. Yet, the very coarse approach to lake FMU categories has the danger of leading to similar problems in the future. In the circumstances of severe degradation and ongoing decline of the health of lakes in the region, where lakes can suffer near irreversible change, more focus on lakes is required. And a more refined approach to lake FMUs would also prevent the sacrificial lake scenario that offsetting or compensation could otherwise enable, and provide that the NPSFM non-compulsory values need to be identified for named lakes. Now, paragraph 83, I've stated that should the court consider this matter better left to the next plan change, preliminary findings would provide direction on that matter. Signals to landowners' future planning. In addition to the above technical information, Ms. Maher's proposed changes at the commencement of Schedule B and 3.11.6 would provide honest and upfront narrative information for landowners on the interim nature of both nutrient management tools and target attribute states. Paragraph 85. Although Fish and Game abides the decision of the court on the dry stock drafting gateway, it opposes the use of the nitrogen risk scorecard in PC1 as a gateway or a measure for medium or low risk farming, and says the court has not been provided sufficient information to undertake an informed assessment of the tool under Section 32. Evidence is lacking on the different cohorts and the potential implications for achieving PC1's objectives. They need influences on contaminant leaching occur beyond factors that the farmer has direct control over. Yet the scorecard does not include the assessment of the farm's inherent risk. It was therefore unsurprising that the Abacus Fire report showed the NRS was not a good predictor of overseer N loss, because overseer includes climate, topography and soils. And that has relevance under Policy 1D, which talks about the tool needed to reflect risk. Fish and Game does not accept the tool should be measured against the criterion simple, transparent and understandable by farmers, or that farmers should be able to populate a tool themselves without a specialised advisor, because the risk of leaching contaminants is multidimensional and is not simple. Difficulties of data entry were verified by the evidence of federated farmers, and the evidence was some farmers prefer the scorecard and others prefer overseer. Even as a gateway for putting existing activities back to them into bins, not fines, a sorting hat, which is another person mentioned to me, for different grafting dates proposed for dairy are not broadly equivalent and will create confusion and potential unfairness for non-frontier or pan-farming landowners. And just add to my submissions here that I adopt the submissions of Ms. Carruthers or Wairahi Pastoral at her paragraph 37 and her footnote 82, with the exception of the redrafting proposed by Ms. Dines. The NRS has not been the subject of an independent published peer review, does not rely on a comprehensive literature review relating to the loss of contaminants to water, cannot be ground truth, and is only suitable for dairy. The data required to populate it is a subset of the data required to run the overseer model. But the court has not been provided with an analysis of whether the data would provide an adequate level of information for a future regime that includes allocation compared to the NLLR. Well, it's flagged in Policy 10. Here it talks about preparing for further diffuse discharge reduction for any future management regime, including potentially the allocation of diffuse discharges of contaminants and subsequent regional plans by collecting information. So,
I mean, isn't the danger here deferring something that will get people underway and headed in the right direction for the sake of hoping that there will be something better that's yet to be identified and will come along in sufficient time to do these things?
Yes, there is, and so although Fish and Game considers that plan change one is a compromise, it hasn't opposed.
Indeed.
Thank
you. But there are, and obviously with a compromise there's a recognition that you can't always get what you want, and you've got to work out, well, what's the priority? And I suppose the question is, from Fish and Game's point of view, what is the priority? Is it to get all of the farmers, and in particular, the intensive farmers, or the higher risk farmers, even though they don't like to be called that, to get them into a regime where steps are being taken on each farm to improve the situation? Because the information we're going to gather, I mean, I suspect that all of the experts in the field could predict the nature of the information we're going to gather, couldn't they?
Yes, and I think Dr. Crystal said that these land holds a lot of information, but then somebody else referred to having piles of FFP and to extract information from that. But that particular item there isn't the primary, I should say, isn't the primary objection to the
NRA. No, I understand, but in terms of one could go through all of the methods that you referred to, and just for the sake of argument and the analysis, be concerned that perfection is being turned against adequacy. I mean, a comprehensive literature review, how long do we wait? How much? I suppose that's really the question. Let me put it this way. Does your client consider that the use of something like a scorecard would mean that no progress was made?
No, but it's highly uncertain what progress is going to be made with a scorecard. Together with the issue that Waraki Pastoral has put forward is that because the scorecard only deals with dairy and the effective grazed area, if you have somebody in the top 25th percentile wishing to become a medium or low, the scorecard doesn't reward mitigation such as riparian planting or retiring of grazed area on that land. I understand that part of the splitting the categories into control and discretionary is that there would be an incentive for a farmer in a discretionary activity to move down to control. But the score, in order to do that, you should incentivise things like, in my submission, diversifying the farm away from dairy if that's what's required, planting riparian, perhaps planting ephemerals with as has been suggested by others. None of that would be rewarded by the scorecard.
Not by the scorecard. But it might well be something which a sensible consenting officer would look at and say, oh, well, that's a real positive. And notwithstanding the scorecard, which is a very rough and ready sorting hat, I'm noting that they're retiring half of their pasture. I mean, I don't know to what extent we are attempting to have a one-size-fits-all plug in the numbers and it will give you the answer. Method, are we?
Well, Fishing Game's got a real concern with moving away from overseer, particularly on the basis of a scorecard that doesn't take into account the biophysicals and these other good things that happen on the farm, without further analysis. The other key issue is that HDR with regards to the data entry requirements, and I acknowledge that Fishing Game doesn't have any farm systems evidence at this hearing. But that's another very important issue from Fishing Game's perspective. So I'll go on to discuss this lack of clarity, why Mr. Tribble. I should also say there that the issue seems to be that the inner LMR is potentially going to be expensive, but we've had different evidence about what the cost is for fair and over-certified and evidence that it's not so significant as $10,000, as I think some people have claimed. So. Paragraph 86. It's unclear to Fish and Game why Mr. Travolta withdrew support for the nitrogen leaching loss rate when decisions under appeal already recognised the OCS limitations. The NLR was not used as an absolute number in PC1. So the government's advice was misinterpreted. And I don't propose to read A to D, which set out, which goes into some detail.
Yeah, no, I think we've been through that ourselves. We've been through those reports as they came out. I think this is a useful summary, thank you, of the various matters. And again, as with most things in this field, it's not a binary question of overseer, right or wrong. It's like, again, and repeating something which has been said by this court on numerous occasions, all models are wrong. The question is whether it's useful for some purpose. And your point is that overseer still has some uses, and you are citing from the reports which have criticised overseer, you've cited the relevant portions which make the point that in fact there are still things that can be used.
So, paragraph 80 that the Ministry of the Environment developed draft assessment criteria to determine nutrient models fit for purpose use and has established an associated review group. And I haven't said there that I should also say that they're developing their own risk assessment matrix. There is no evidence that Regional Council took up the Ministry's offer to review the tools at issue here, although I should also say Dr. Scarsbrook did mention he had been in touch with people at the ministry. That would have provided quite useful information, but overseer has now undergone extensive review. There is a good understanding of its strengths and weaknesses, and the PCE's comments around the level of documentation and transparency desirable in a regulatory setting is considerably more lacking for the NRS than overseer. So, in my submission, the NRS requires greater caution with respect to the use of a regulatory setter. Scope for the introduction of the NRS as a consenting gateway has not been shown in Federated Farmers of Fonterra, Dairy New Zealand's appeals. Although Fonterra and Dairy New Zealand's notices of appeal seek ability to use the NRS as another metric to demonstrate nitrogen reduction alternative to overseer, that is already provided for by Policy 2, Capital B.
No one is maintaining a jurisdictional objection to the possibility of a scorecard being used. There's a question about what it is used for and how it's introduced. As you say here, Policy 2B contemplates it.
Yes, that's right. So the jurisdictional objection would be to placing the NLR and using.
I understand that.
Yes.
Keeping the NLR and relying on overseer as the only current model available to do that and allowing for other methods is within scope, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yes, so that would be Policy 2, Capital B, C3, demonstrate that the tool does not reliably account for the benefits of contaminant mitigation measures that are in place. You could use the nitrogen risk scorecard for that purpose. Whether it would be adequate would be a consent officer's decision. So, Fish and Game continues to oppose the use of Section 293 for inserting the NRS and seeks opportunity to make further submissions on the appropriate use of that section, should the court contemplate that as a way forward. Now, I've read these submissions on behalf of Horticulture New Zealand, so I expect to need to make submissions on scope of Section 293 in closing, based on my reading of those submissions. Finally, including the gateway methodology within Schedule B would enable the ease of change of that schedule when new tools become available. valuable. And
it does seem to us, I think at this stage, on a very preliminary basis, that what you say at 90 obviates the need for us to pursue a Section 293 question.
Yes, but I should elaborate on what I'm saying at 90.
Yeah.
There has been a discussion amongst the planners, yes, about where to put these tolls. And Ms. Nara's opinion is that you put the tolls in the Stupid Bay, it's much easier to change in the future, which I'm sure it's aware. But I'm not saying that the nitrogen risk scorecard should be placed in Stupid Bay at the present time, because Fishing Game maintains that opposition to it as a solution had.
Right.
Yes.
But again, that's a merits issue within the scope of this hearing. It's not something that requires any additional alternative process under Section 293 before we can address it. Is it?
No. So, Christian Graham's position is that there is. Depends on how Schedule B is to be used, but if it's to be used as a gateway, then Fish and Game says that is outside the current scope of appeals.
As a gateway, as an alternative to the NLLR.
Yes. That there's scope to use it alongside Overseer.
Sorry, that's what I did. That was what I meant there as an alternative.
Right.
To bring it in while retaining Overseer as the NLLR is within the scope of these appeals and the breadth of them. To replace the NLLR as is in the draft that we've been working on with the NRS, that presents an issue.
Yes, I think I need to clarify.
Yes.
So, on reading the appeals, even to get it in as a gateway alongside Overseer, as a gateway, appears to be outside the scope of appeals. What I was going to say before is it can be added in alongside Overseer once you get through the gateway.
Presumably, what you're basically saying is you've got to keep using Overseer as a starting point, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it can be added in after the gateway.
Yes, that's my reading of the appeals.
And the activity status has been, or activity class has been determined.
Yes, alongside that, it can be added in alongside Overseer once you want. Yes. So, no doubt others will be submitting on that scope for sure, but with that, I'll just say that Mr. Anderson, the Forest and Virgin, has wishes to adopt these submissions. I understand he may be wishing to file a brief set of closing submissions.
Well, yeah, okay.
That may be joint. Will that be acceptable, John?
Well, what we've discussed would be that there would be closings in writing, and then we'd be looking at an opportunity for parties to be heard in the week of December, when we might have questions ourselves. I don't think we set a date yet,
I think you provided two dates, and I've told Mr. Anderson of those dates and asked him to come up to Auckland. So.
Tuesday and Wednesday, I think, were the dates that we suggested, but I don't think the dates have been suggested.
Right, well, myself, I'm due to be in Wellington for a heads of bench meeting on the afternoon of the 6th, so it may be that we're narrowing it down to the 5th.
Thank you, sir, and I'll wait in the direction on when or that we will have to get those kinds of submissions on.
Yeah, no, we'll do. Thank you. All right, now, in terms of. Sorry.
Good morning, Mr. Zong. Thank you very much again for your submissions. They've covered a lot of easy to answer questions, so and sort of covered a lot of the things that we're going through in our minds. In terms of your paragraphs 43 to 46, you're talking about water trading, and you indicate that you feel that if it's to be allowed at all, it should relate to a type of ancestral land. And we've heard from the Federated Departments that they consider that some provision should be made for that. Do you know if anyone has come up with any possible wording for how that might be incorporated into a plan?
No, I don't believe anybody cares. The post-conferencing version of the policy file, which is the council's version, provides wording. There is an overall reduction of diffuse discharge of each of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and microbial pathogens, and an increase in diffuse discharge of those four is compensated by a reduction in diffuse discharge of those four. So the way that that's worded, it's not entirely clear that it has to be phosphorus to phosphorus. So that wording is the wording basis which would provide for that sort of water trading. That's separate to the general principles which is pushed against primary position, which is you should only trade phosphorus to phosphorus, etc. And it should go through the effects management hierarchy. So you can't go straight to compensation because compensation is the one that could potentially allow you to trade E. coli for nitrogen. It's under that compensation heading, as per Dr. Corkery's evidence. And then you would apply the principles such as trading up. So the distinction is that the allocation, or however you like to call it, the regime for tangata whenua would allow you to go straight to that compensation.
Okay, so basically you'd have two options. You'd either have to bring the whole region down to being compliant before they could do that, or they'd have to have someone who gave up their nitrogen allocation, for example, to enable that nitrogen allocation from the TWAA.
Yes, and I agree that it's still very stringent. It would still be quite a stringent regime.
Okay, that's good, thank you. That clarifies where we're at anyway. His Honour raised the issue of the BPO, and it's something that I've certainly been thinking about. And it also is relevant to the biophysical issue, because biophysical can be used to allow for a lesser reduction in some areas depending on the climate and the soil conditions. Where you've got an over-allocation, shouldn't there be a requirement to sort of do the best you can regardless of the biophysical conditions? So in other words, if you can get a little bit more by reducing everywhere rather than just in the ones with the favourable soil conditions, shouldn't that just be planted across the board from the DPF?
You thought
I
read that maybe
it
actually be applied across the board. I'm not quite sure what the fix
is. Well, as you're aware, I'm sitting on the case down in Manor Children, and one of the issues there is the use of biophysical to mean that some farms may need to do less than in others. And so what I'm wondering is, why would you allow someone to do less when there's a requirement to keep reducing overall? But that's where I'm coming from, probably not explaining it very well.
Well, I agree with that, that the potentially relates to the economic philosophy around directing land uses to low risk land and allowing some development there, which is, I agree, that's the next plan change.
Yeah. Okay, well, just coming on to that then, in terms of the economics and the practicality issues, one of the things I found on other cases is that it really is important to make sure you allow enough time to do things rather than race in and try and do too much too soon. And one of the big issues that I see is what is providing certainty that things will happen within a defined time frame, but allowing that level of flexibility. And Ms. Ma has addressed that in part by talking about an 8-year time frame. I'm not sure what that time frame is, but one of the things I have suggested is that you've got to do something as soon as practicable, but in no case more than 5 years or whatever it happens to be. Do you have a view on that kind of approach? The fencing of streams.
I think you'll have to ask Ms. Ma that question, but my overall big picture view is that it's better to address the time frame rather than move to a more flexible and uncertain regime.
So that's fairly difficult to do. Everyone wants certainty, but everyone wants to have some more flexibility.
Well, by that I mean use the word for word, what's practicable to think. And I do agree that it's very difficult to bring these sorts of consents into the Resource Management Act framework, but that's the framework that we've got at the moment.
Okay, one last point. You said that it's important to be right up front about talking about that there's more change to come. And I didn't actually think Ms. Mars' suggestions address that in the kind of way that I think is very clear, because my understanding at the present time is that there could be some very substantial reductions in nitrogen required and other parameters coming up sometime after this plan change, and there doesn't seem to be that much of an indication of the scale of these things here. Is that what you're talking about, is having the reality put into this in terms of what might be required?
Yes, absolutely, and perhaps it could be made more clear that in the examples that pushing down keeps going about actually is late, where even to maintain those rates you're going to have I think the JWE sees significant reductions in nitrogen and phosphorus in late catchments. So Ms. Ma had tried to address that by her changes, but possibly they could have been clearer.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, there is just one other thing, and one of the things I have expressed concern about is expectations of when things are going to be measurably better. And in terms of nitrogen, in particular in lakes and things like that, even in any water body, it could easily be 10 to 15 years, 20 years before we actually see any measurable improvements. Do you have a view on that?
Yes, no, that's my understanding as well. On page 52 of the post-conferencing version, page 53, there's been wording put in there to discuss the lag time for contaminants to reach surface water, so there may be lags in nitrogen entering surface water. And that's intended to address the issue of whether those improvements will be seen actually be seen in surface water.
Mm.
That potentially could be made clearer as well.
Yeah, I think plunging is moving in the right direction, but if people are expecting things to be achieved in 10 years and we know now that they're not, then I think it's probably sensible to say that in a much clearer way than the document does at the present time.
Yes. I should note there that it is in its submission, especially going to greater improvement within a lesser time period.
I can understand why you want to do it.
Mm.
I just come from a point of view of what's actually going to happen, what's realistically achievable.
Mm.
Because I don't think it's in anybody's interest to sort of have unrealistic expectations.
Mm. Yes.
Do you agree with it?
Yes, I do, but I don't. That Fish and Game has agreed with Objective 2, as has all the other parties, so would probably be very concerned if that's changed.
Oh, look, I understand that, but I'm not going to back off saying I think something's possible.
Thanks,
Mike. Thank you very much.
Well, Objective 2 is about progress.
Yes, now I look at it.
You'd like to amend your notice of appeal? You'd like to amend your notice of appeal?
Yes. Because it says being met no later, then
yes.
So, yeah.
But, well, and you're welcome to advance that over the priors from your colleagues. But the Commissioner's point remains in a real world point. And that is, we can say all we like. Ultimately, the question comes, how quickly can we get these things to happen in the water?
Yes, and I think these are questions for us now. The targets.
Indeed. And they depend on the actions of people rather than the words and the plan.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Should we take a slightly early break and return it to, or do we think we could get through, is it Mr. Daniel, quickly?
I'm proposing to call Mr. Clee first.
Oh, okay. Do you know to what extent is there likely to be cross-examination of Mr. Two? It will be a little while.
It'll take
yes,
about 20 minutes, I think, sir.
Well, then, I suspect the better thing might be to take a break now and start at 2 o'clock.
Thank you, sir.